And Rosalind and Jonathan, thank you for our readings this morning. Many of us who live here count amongst Sheffield's blessings accessibility to the Peak District, fantastic countryside right on our doorstep, where essentially we can roam to our heart's content. This was a privilege that was brought home to me some years ago when I spent a couple of months living in Spain near a couple of national parks. But national parks without the right to roam. You could wander into the parks, but you had to stick to the authorised tracks. And to make sure you did so, fences were set up about 10 to 20 feet either side of the path. It was hugely frustrating. You could see this amazing countryside just out of reach. You just couldn't get there. Apparently, a version of this hit the news here in England a few weeks back because there are nearly 3,000 hectares of land with the right to roam that are completely enclosed by private land. If you could get there, you could roam. But you can't get in. The promise of freedom destroyed, made a lie by what happens round about it. And that's an image I would like us to take with us as we press into our gospel reading this morning from John 2. And in so doing, we'll be using one of the ways of reading the Bible or eating bread you might have been exploring in your Lent groups, because I gather that's the subject of Lent groups this year. It's what I would call a diachronic way of reading the Bible. Ah, a historical critical way of reading the Bible. Ha! Basically, it says, what was going on at the time? So what does this mean? That's it, really. It's very straightforward. But if you use it as you come to John 2, actually, you can come to a very different understanding of what was going on in the temple, at least if you're used to the idea that God is a bit annoyed about fuss and bubble in church or buying and selling in church, because I don't actually think that's what this is about. So then let's ask the question, why were there money changers and traders of livestock in the temple in the first place? I mean, when you got here this morning, you weren't confronted with a money changer and someone dragging a crate of pigeons in the entrance hall, were you? So firstly, the animals. The animals. Animal sacrifice was intrinsic to much of what went on in the temple. There was only one temple, and most people had to travel a long way to get there. Rather than drag a reluctant sheep the whole way, far easier to take the money with you and buy one when you get there. I guess that makes sense, doesn't it? But here's the rub. The money. I said take the money with you, but the money was a problem. Since the Roman occupation, the coinage used in Palestine was Roman. And on one side of Roman coinage was the head of the emperor. And in Roman social and religious order, the emperor was a god. Ah. And the coins proclaimed this with the title divine. So in this era, the divine Augustus. To have used Roman money in the Jerusalem temple dedicated to the God of Israel would have been unacceptable, a blasphemy. So you needed money changers to change your denarii and your sestercii into something a bit more acceptable. In the first century, the chosen acceptable currency was the Tyrian drachma, a silver coin. But here's the odd thing about the Tyrian drachma. It had an image on it as well. The image of the god Melkart, roughly equivalent to Baal. Have you heard of the god Baal? If you think back maybe to 1 Kings and all the blood-curdling stuff as the cult of Baal came head-to-head with the cult of the Hebrew God. Elijah, Elisha, lightning from heaven, kill the lot of them, this kind of stuff. It was very violent stuff. And you're probably surprised that within less than a millennium, it was fine to have Baal kicking around in the temple. Trouble with the Roman emperor, but Baal, yeah, who cares? Doesn't really make sense, does it? So what's most likely is that sort of religious reason was being used to stick two fingers up to Rome. We're not having your emperor here. We'll have this one. And while we're doing it, we'll make a lot of money on the side by changing money. Now, that kind of behavior is something to which you can imagine Jesus taking exception. What was he said? Straining on a gnat and swallowing a camel? Oh, it doesn't get much more camel-like than this, does it? Making people jump through hoops, making money off the poor and off pilgrims. You can imagine him being a bit peeved. But I don't think it was this that really, really drove Jesus' anger that day. Just ask yourself where this event happened. The gospel says it was in the outer court of the temple. It was the only bit of the temple complex into which you could have brought Roman money. Because the outer court wasn't the holy bit. Imagine the temple in Jerusalem as a little bit like a Russian doll with successive layers as you go inwards. And each layer, as you go in, holier than the last. Each layer access more and more restricted, more and more regulation as you go, until you get right to the center, to the Holy of Holies, the place of God's freedom. But all these layers in between, this outer court, this profane court, it was known as the court of the Gentiles, because anybody could hang around there. It was the only place in the temple where Gentiles were permitted. And on the wall that separated the court of the Gentiles from the next court in and the rest of the temple was a sign that simply said, if you cross this wall, we kill you. We know that because one of the signs remains. It's in a museum in Turkey. Cross this wall, we kill you. For Gentiles who yearned for God, or were simply questioning and wondering, this was as close as he got. I suppose a bit like standing outside the restricted access land, gazing inwards longingly at the place where there's freedom to roam, but being unable to get there. This was a separation that it was Jesus' very purpose to explode and to obliterate forever. But for now, the time this event happened, this was a precious place for Gentiles. It was a place of encounter, of discovery. A place intended to be filled with the promise of the presence of God and of God's invitation to peace and friendship and restoration. The court of the Gentiles was, perhaps you could say, missional space. It was, if you like, the Jesus space, the reach outward space, the self-offering space. And what had it become? Well, firstly, it had become packed full of other things, hadn't it? If you wanted a space of questioning, encounter, and welcome, you probably wouldn't make it like Meadow Hall on the first day of the sales after Christmas, would you now? Nothing wrong with shops. Nothing wrong with sales. But hardly conducive to the purpose for which the court of the Gentiles was there. But moreover, and I suspect more importantly, the things with which the court of the Gentiles had become overwhelmed Well, they were about faith, sure, but they were about the faith of those who already belonged. There were hang-ups that the faithful had about worship and about purity and about politics. And to keep their space, the inner courts, pure, to keep them looking right, feeling right, being right, they kind of dumped this stuff down right there in the missional space. They'd put their own hang-ups, their own disagreements as obstacles to those who were searching. They underlined in every move they made that here you can never belong unless you behave. That's what the court of the Gentiles had become. The place of invitation and welcome. You can never belong here unless you behave. Now that would have struck right at the very heart of the mission of Jesus, at the core of his being, at the heart of a God who reaches out to draw us close, reaches out to the stranger, the struggling, and the destitute. And Jesus was angry. Angry. Let's make no bones about it. And small wonder. So that's what I offer you today as a reading of John 2. In my way of reading it, there are other ways to do so. But I'll leave you with a question to ponder. In what ways, here and now, in 21st century England, do we, the faithful, or let's be honest, more or less faithful, in what ways do we dump our preoccupations, our hang-ups, our unresolved issues? To what extent do we dump those down in the way of those to whom God cries out in welcome? In what ways do we fence in the right to roam in the grace of God with our own barely logical preoccupations? How do we, in our day, essentially tell people that here you must behave before you can belong? Amen.